Welcome back to the Green Front, and we now have Alone Tall joining us, and that's a perfect guest for today, because today, you may not know this, Jewish listeners probably should, it's February 8th, and it is Tu B'Shvat, that is the celebration of the tree. Can tell us more about what that means, and we'll be going from this segment talking about trees and other things that are being planted in Israel to green that country, in the oasis in the desert. Then we'll be going to the last segment, which will be all about leaf blowers. So I see some connection there. Hope you do as well. Welcome to the Green Front, Alone, and sorry to keep you waiting, but we had a guest on that I just couldn't hang up on. Very topical, if you heard any of it, talking about why these Republican presidential candidates are not believing science. And, you know, Republicans for Environmental Progress, an interesting topic for us here. I don't know if you've been following our presidential.
We have. Thanks. It's great to be here. Really a pleasure. And I think speaking on behalf of the international environmental community from outside of the U.S., we're somewhat appalled that the last decade has brought to a polarization and politicization of the environment in the U.S. And we remember the days of Richard Nixon, who was a Republican who created the EPA, and even senior George Bush. And it's a pity that it's become a partisan issue. We should all be on the same side on these ones.
Alone Tall, you were with Ben-Gurion University, and if our listeners are wondering why you don't sound Israeli, you sound more American, it's because you went to college here?
That's correct, yeah. I've been doing an undergraduate, and I did a doctorate as well, but my professional life is in Israel. Originally as an environmental advocate, and more recently as an academic, and I chaired the committee that oversaw Israeli forest policy for the last several years.
And are you affiliated with the Jewish National Fund, which is...
That's correct. Israel has a unique situation where a public corporation, the Jewish National Fund, in a, it's called a treaty with the government, has taken responsibility for planting with the Ministry of Agricultural Oversight. So in that context, I'm on the board, and I chair the professional committee for forestry.
And tell us about your environmental beginnings. What got you interested, concerned about planetary health, and what are you doing in Israel to make Israel a greener country? I've been there twice, once when I was 16, once when I was 35, and both those times, well, 16 was before I was green-minded, but I didn't see much sign of eco-activism there. You know, Israel always dealing with its survival, so almost the attitude that I sensed of, you know, can't be bothered with that, with recycling, you know. But things have changed a lot since I was there.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're moving forward. I grew up in North Carolina and much of my childhood, so I spent a lot of time in pine forests in that state. When I got to Israel, I was kind of surprised because it's a Mediterranean climate. You have to remember that if you open the Bible, you see there that there were woodlands across the ancient land of Israel, and we know that from pollen residues and wood that we can find even in archaeological sites. But thousands of years of conquerors who came through there literally decimated the forest, so much so that at the end of World War One, when the British threw the Ottoman Turks out, less than 1% of the original woodlands were remaining and surviving. And it really is makes our efforts to green the land something unique internationally. Everything we do basically is restoration ecology. And it's hard to figure out exactly what was there before us and what we can provide now. But 10% of the lands of Israel are designated to be forests, and an additional 25% set aside for nature reserves. And for a small country, I think that's quite a significant commitment to preservation. Of course, we have our problems with pollution, and I can go in depth about that as well, but we have done a few things okay.
And all of us Sunday schoolers, of course, contributed to all those trees being planted in Israel, right?
That's correct. Although it's an interesting thing, you know, originally the planting was done before the state as a sort of a land sovereignty tool. The Turkish land laws were still in force, and they said if it's use or lose, if you don't use the land, you lose ownership. So that's where they started planting. And then in 1948, when the state of Israel was created, we had, hundreds of thousands of refugees coming from the Holocaust and then the Arab lands throughout their Jewish community. So we had a lot of refugees, and forestry was basically a public works program. But one thing led to another, and before you know it, we really had ourselves a serious ecological challenge here. And we realized that we needed ecologists on board because the original monocultures, which were all pine, which we planted, were being devoured by, pests. And we really needed to be a bit more sophisticated in the kinds of management we were doing in our forests so that they'd be more sustainable and long-lasting.
And at Ben-Gurion University, I know you are really leading the way in terms of development of clean technology.
Ben-Gurion University has, I think, many of the schools, a commitment to top-level engineering projects, and we certainly have some very exciting innovations in the area of solar technology, which I hope will be the next generation of the concentrated photovoltaics. I myself sit in the ecology department, and here we work on areas involving combating desertification. In fact, every 2 years we have the world's largest conference on the issue of desertification in conjunction with the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification and with UNESCO, because Israel, even with all of its exigencies and security challenges, has really been, I think, a model of a country that's taken this problem of how do we deal with the deterioration of dry lands seriously. We have made mistakes, but we've also done some things right.
Is Tu B'Shvat, since I started the segment with that mention, celebrated widely in Israel?
Oh, yes, it is. In fact, that's one of the exciting things about this third Jewish Commonwealth of ours. You know, this was a holiday which existed back in the days of the Talmud. We don't read about it in the Bible, but it was a celebration. And the Bible says that basically there's several different Jewish New Years. There's the regular New Year, which you call Rosh Hashanah. Some people say that the Passover holiday is a New Year, because it sort of marks the creation of the Jewish nation. But we also talk about the New Year for the trees, which is on the 15th day of the month of Shvat, which is Tu B'Shvat. Tu is the acronym for 15 in Hebrew letters. And this was a wonderful celebration, but it was sort of lost over the years when Jews were dispersed in diasporas and exile. And with the return of Jews to Israel, it was a tradition that was revived, and it's a wonderful Arbor Day. It's really almost a national sport. Everybody is out planting trees, every school child, and there's a whole host of exciting nature activities. And recently, a whole ritual has been set up on what we call a Seder, which is sort of like a festive feast, where we really celebrate the fruits of the land and the original biblical produce, which is such an important part of our heritage.
Not such a big deal here for American Jews, although more observant Jews know, but my daughter happens to go to the Jewish community high school, the Bay, so she mentioned it. Otherwise, I might not have known that, but I thought that
was perfect. But you'd be amazed. This Seder is coming on. There's I think it's still on its nation stage, but there is a wonderful Jewish environmental movement which has also revitalized. In fact, if anybody's in the Bay Area, there's a wonderful program called Urban Adama, which is an organic farm in Berkeley, and they're having a wonderful celebration tonight. You'll find them cropping up across the country here in the U.S. as well.
There's also a group called Eco Jews, and they started
terrific.
Something called the Trees Task Force, and I'm on that. So, yes, there seem to be a disproportionate amount of Jews involved in the environmental movement. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's several explanations for it. Most of it, I think that in general justice has been a passion, if not an obsession, with Jews. And you see Jews disproportionately represented in other social movements, certainly in the civil rights movement, in the women's movement, people like Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug and like. And so it's not surprising that this social movement has also attracted a large number of Jews. I think it may be forced them to expand their vision of justice to include not only humans but the other creatures of the land. But I think that there's, you know, a deep idealistic requirement in Jewish law to mend the world. We say that in our prayers every day, that we have a responsibility, and certainly this planet needs healing.
Tikkun Olam, and I started something called America's Green Tea Party for those of us who are steamed that they're playing politics of the planet, and I have house parties, and I call them Green Tikkun Olam. And it's a Jewish setting, because it's what we're required to do, right? Repair the world. And this is
I think so,
it.
And I think that the Jewish people who waited so many thousands of years to return to the homeland, now that we're back there, we really have a responsibility to be the responsible and conscientious stewards of the land. I mean, I think the first 100 years of Zionism, the Jewish national movement, really had to be focused on things like security and survival or economic prosperity. But I'm reckoning that the next 100 years really should focus as its priority on returning the harmony between the Jews and their homeland. And I think there's a lot of organizations that are trying to do that. The environmental movement in Israel has really blossomed. I just did a study. We have over 100 environmental groups. There's an expression, two Jews, three synagogues, so you can add in four environmental groups to that. We have a lot of them. And the oldest is the Jewish National Fund, which has wonderful people working for them in the Bay Area and in general across America and in 22 different countries, where people who care about the sort of the promised land, and preserving it can find all kinds of compelling projects where they can be partners and make a contribution.
Okay, I want to ask you about two big subject areas, and we just have a couple minutes left, so if you could kind of summarize what's going on with, you know, solar power in Israel. Since you are in the middle of the desert, I would hope it's everywhere. Is that the case? And then also, since you are in the middle of the desert, water is a big issue. Are you starting with desalination?
Okay, well, first of all, with regard to solar, the truth of the matter is in the 1970s, Israel was the world leader. We have a requirement still on the books, which says all buildings 8 stories or less have to have solar passive water heaters on the roofs. And that saves us about 4% of the electricity this year. I'm rather sheepishly would tell you that in terms of creating electricity, Israel's fallen way behind. Although our technologies are out there, and a high percentage of the world's photovoltaic and solar thermal plants are from Israeli technology. Within Israel, we only have one facility at the Arava Power down south. I think this has been a failure of government policy, which hasn't taken greenhouse gas reduction seriously, and maybe a failure of the environmental movement, which haven't put our decision-makers' feet to the fire as much as they should. In contrast, desalination, I think, is an area where Israel leads the world. We have the largest reverse osmosis plant in the world, and we can now produce 1,000 liters of water. We call that a cubic meter of water, for about 52 cents. And I want you to think about that a little bit, how much we pay for bottled water in this country or any country, and we can make about 1,000 liters for 50 cents, and that water is cleaner and better than anything you can have. So Israel really has started. It's mostly based on Israeli technologies, which involve special membranes which push the water through at high pressures, and the salt stays on one side, the H2O goes on the other. And, of course, the big technological challenge is how do we do this without burning too much fossil fuels and increasing the burden, the carbon burden on the atmosphere.
And what's happening with Shai Agassi's Better World operation?
The Better Place, this electrical Better vehicles, place. Actually, it's a good time to ask, because just last week the first 100 cars were sent out on the roads in Israel. This is a project which I think is visionary and I think could revolutionize the way we do electric cars. The reasons why people don't buy electric cars is because they're really expensive, maybe $60,000-$70,000 for the cheapest ones, and people are concerned about having range anxiety. They're going to run out of power and not be able to go anywhere. And what Mr. Agassi's done, he was a highly successful very young software mogul, and decided this was something he could do to change the world. And so with his system, basically you buy a car, in this case it's a Renault car, and you own everything in the car but the battery. So you don't have to pay that money for the battery. He's done that for you, and you just pay like a cell phone plan for a certain amount of miles when you buy the car. And those stations all across Israel, where if you happen to go beyond your 100-kilometer range, you can come in, and the time is really 59 seconds, but they say it could take as much as 2 or 3 minutes, but 59 seconds, they will replace your battery with a fresh one, and you go on your merry way. And so in a small country like Israel, this makes a lot of sense for many commuters. Of course, you can charge the battery at night, and they give you charges at your home and at work. So I'm hoping this will really change the fleet in Israel, and I can tell you this, that because cars in Israel are taxed very highly, as much as 100%, and the fact that electric vehicles only tax 10% on import taxes, there is a big incentive now to buy electric cars, and I think Israel could lead the way. Copenhagen is also starting now, looking at Australia. So this could be a very interesting development. Of course, the key here is to do all the charging of the batteries at night, and that way you don't have to add any power plants to your grid, because usually at night the base load is not being utilized, and so you can take that extra electricity, which is being made, and put it into the cars.
Okay, last quick question. You are here in the Bay Area doing something at Stanford and also in conjunction with the daughter of Wangari Maathai, who's going to be visiting.
That's correct. I've been very, very fortunate this year to be the guest of the Stanford Center for Conservation Biology with some of the great ecologists in this country, and I'm writing a book about forests and Israeli forestry policy. But that brought me to be in touch with the Green Belt movement in Kenya, Wangari Maathai's organization, which really has planted tens of millions of trees across Kenya and Africa, empowering women and changing their landscape. Tragically, Wangari Maathai passed away this fall, and a great loss to Kenya and to the world community at large. She did win the Nobel Peace Prize for her work. But her daughter, Wanjira, continues this critical work and will be visiting the Bay Area. And I believe the only real open public forum she's talking at is at Stanford University next Monday. So if you have any listeners in the Bay Area and they care about trees in Africa, I would invite you on Monday, the 13th of February at 4:15. They come to the Y2E2 building, room 111, and you can find us on the Stanford website. Just look for Wanjira Math Ice Talk at Stanford next Monday, and we can all perhaps let her know how much we believe that restoring the ecology of Africa is important to that continent's future.
Alon Tal, thank you so much for joining me, and happy Tubishvat to you.
Happy Tubishvat to you and all the listeners.
Hope to see you at that event. And now we're going to bring in, without delay, because we are running behind, but so much to talk about today, my next guest, who is Joanna Nagler, and she is an activist against leaf blowing. So we go from trees to leaves, as I promised, leaves. And Joanna, thanks for your patience.
Happy to be here, Betsy.
So wonderful to meet you on air. We've been emailing back and forth, and I said yes, you can come on the show, because just a couple of weeks ago, we're in a new rented house, new to us, renting it, and it's all windows and skylights, and there's a gardener that comes every other week, and they do leaf blowing, and it is so loud because there's terrible insulation in this house. I was trying to hide in the bathroom. I almost went into a closet. It was I felt like I was under assault, and I got so irritated and so upset. It went on for 25 minutes, and my husband said, "What are they doing? They're blowing leaves around. Where are they blowing them?" You know.
And
so
that,
I said, "Yes, I want to know more about this scourge."
And it is a scourge. I think the thing to keep in mind is that noise is usually the issue that propels people to get involved, and it's certainly the issue that got me involved. I live in Burlingame. It's a small burb just south of San Francisco, and from the face of it, you'd think our neighborhood was quiet and quaint and sweet. We're in a condo apartment neighborhood a couple blocks from the old antique Burlingame Library, and we've been here for a long time, and it used to be quiet, and now pretty much every single day, and I mean every day, 7 days a week, from morning till night, there's constant leaf blower noise. So that was what got me involved in the issue. And once I started to research it, and after 20 years as a professional writer, that's part of my gig, is to learn how to research things, I discovered that there are way, way, way more issues than just the noise issue and the decibel violations. And I'll just catapult right into those. But the first issue, and pretty much the huge under-recognized issue, is worker health. This is really the elephant in the room around this issue. Nobody is dealing with it. Some of that has to do with the invisibility of the workers. That people go to work and they say, "Well, it's not my problem. I'm not at home." And the issues for workers are really serious. It's hearing loss, first of all, and I've gone around on my bicycle for the last 3 years, and I just stop and talk to workers and say, "Hey, how come you're not wearing ear protection? Why don't you wear earplugs?" And they say, "I lost my hearing the first week I was using this machine."
Oh, my goodness.
So, I mean, it's serious, but the hearing loss, inhalation of emissions, specifically nitrous oxide, respiratory disease issues, there's a doctor at UCSF, Dr. John Balms, who told me that that the NO2 can actually cause structural damage, tissue damage to the throat. Stress disorders are, that's happening with the residents as well as the workers, and no one is dealing with this issue. There's an official at the San Francisco Department of the Environment that said this is the biggest under-recognized health hazard among workers in the state of California, and no one is addressing it.
Well, you heard it here on the Green Front first. I like to be on the cutting edge here.
Well, and I think what's important for officials to know, and, you know, I've been working with the City Council through the Environmental Council in Burlingame for 3 years, and we've gone back and forth, and, you know, kudos to the members of the council who are supporting this change. But they tend to see it as a neighborhood issue, the right to do whatever I want on my property versus people who are annoyed by this. And what we're trying to do from the Environmental Council standpoint is put this in the framework of a public health issue. Anything I do on my property that impacts your public health is no longer a right to do whatever I want on my property issue. And we understand that we don't burn leaves anymore, even though it's fun and it was easy, right? We don't dump asbestos. We don't dump paints into storm drains. And if we do, we expect as homeowners or as property owners to get fined for that activity.
Or light fires. That's something that's gotten a lot more attention.
Absolutely. And that's a really interesting thing, Betsy, because when I talked to the California Air Resources Board about this, they kind of blew me off a little bit about this and said, "Well, it's really, really not a big issue, and we're going to focus on wood-burning fires." And when you look at the prolific use of leaf blowers and the fact that the American Lung Association came out with a statement that said that a leaf blower run for an hour puts as much carbon emissions into the air as a car driven for 100 miles. And that was actually a good stat when I wrote this report. I wrote a 40-page report to the City Council, and it is available at burlingame.org. If you type in leaf blower report, you'll find it, and it has all kinds of medical data. But just recently, Edmunds, the car reviewing website, Edmunds Inside Line, produced a terrific video, and I can give you the link for this, that measured the 2001 Ford Raptor against the big truck, against the 2012 Fiat 500, against a four-stroke Ryobi leaf blower, and a two-stroke Echo leaf blower. And the results were that the Ryobi leaf blower kicked out 6.8 times more nitrous oxide, NOx, 13.5 times more carbon emissions, and more than 36 times more particulates than the Raptor, right? So, I mean, it's serious. And when we start talking about going beyond emissions, the second biggest issue is, well, I would say actually particulates are a bigger issue than emissions, is the material that's getting blown up by these machines. So as one physician said to me, we would never think to stand in our living room and blow the debris from our living room floor into the air or into a pile. We would understand that that would get into our respiratory tract and it wouldn't be a good idea. But we're doing it outside, and we're doing it up against homes. And we're not protecting anybody who's outside. We're not protecting the particulate matter from coming in through windows, which it does. So here's an interesting fact. I've been working with Dr. David Lighthall out of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. And we used to think that the particulates, the small matters of cadmium, mercury, arsenic, animal feces, pesticides that get blown up by these machines, that they had to be 2.5 microns or larger. Is that right? 2.5 microns was the cutoff point for what could be damaging. Now in research at UCLA and USC, he told me the other day that, no, we're seeing that these ultrafine particles of 0.05 and 0.5 microns are just as dangerous, and they're coming up through the nasal passage and passing the blood-brain barrier and lodging in the brain. So essentially, we're saying they can contribute to all manner of brain disorders, not the least of which is Alzheimer's disease.
Is there a better leaf blower?
Here's the good news, and this is part of the issue with the argument, is the people who are against leaf blowers often say, go back to rakes and brooms. And we've been working really hard with our Bay Area Gardeners Association, and the president and the vice president, Valentine and Jose by name, are terrific guys, and they've worked well with us to create sort of a mitigating solution. But nobody knows what the alternatives are. There's a guy in Los Angeles by the name of Dan Mabe who's running an organization called the Green Station, and since Santa Monica banned both gas and electric, he's been working with the city to train workers on these new alternatives. And I did a matrix on all the machinery that's out there. The best machinery that's out there is a Haga hardscape sweeper, H-A-A-G-A. This thing is rugged enough, it's hand-pushed, and it's rugged enough to pick up cans. So you run that over all your hardscape, your sidewalks, your driveways, everything. And the thing is really effective, it's affordable, and the gardeners never have to pick up the debris. Now, for the turf area, the best thing to use is what's called the sweepers have found to be not so effective, but the mulching lawnmowers and the lawn Ninja 2, it's called the Lawn Ninja 2, is really the best machine that I found and that Dan's using now, and it cuts the grass, mulches the debris. So all that's left then is your rockscapes and your areas where you actually want mulch, so there's an argument for keeping leaves in those areas. But then we're advocating a small Black & Decker electric vacuum, right? So those are the sustainable pieces that are the best on the market now, the Haga hardscape sweeper, the Lawn Ninja 2 mulching lawnmower, and the small Black & Decker. If you look at the manufacturing landscape right now, you know, Echo has really been the least supportive. You know, they send a guy out to try to stop any cities from banning leaf blowers, right?
So that's not Echo as an eco.
No. No, they're definitely not eco. Black & Decker was really probably the most progressive organization that I talked to. I talked to every single manufacturer that makes leaf blowers and said, well, what are you doing? what are you doing to help this issue? What are you doing to reduce decibels? They really are doing some terrific things with electric. They're trying to do some things with cordless. Cordless is really the wave of the future, but this, as you were just talking to your former guest, you know, length of time use is really the issue. You know, can the gardeners use them all day? Do they have to keep recharging? But right now, we do have the tools to do this in an eco-friendly way. It's just people really don't know. So, I mean, my next step is we need a philanthropist to step up and say, here, we're going to give you a chunk of change to get these machines in the hands of gardeners in at least one community, create a green zone like they're doing in some neighborhoods in Los Angeles, and see what the quality of life differential is. See how people feel about it. Because in places where they've done this, it's made a huge difference.
And there are many more people, unfortunately, who are unemployed, underemployed, or just working at home, and they are affected.
Well, and that's a good, I'm glad you brought that up, because first of all, Palo Alto has been dealing with this issue over and over again because there's a larger amount of technology workers who are working out of their homes. And I work with Barbara Ferry, who is a specialist of the U.S. Census Bureau, and we calculated that 55% of residents were home during blower use hours, and that includes airport workers, nurses, police officers, teachers who are home in the afternoon, mothers, home-based workers, tech workers, retirees, children, students. So 55% of our population is being affected by this. And when the city did a survey, we got the second highest response in 2 months than they'd ever gotten on any survey. The first highest was high-speed rail, and we got that response in 2 months instead of 10 months compared to another one. But I also want to say a word about fuel, because a lot of times the workers will come back and say, well, this is going to cost us money. And truthfully, the new machinery would cost somewhere around $800. But when they use this machinery, workers save between $5,400 and $6,600 a year in fuel costs.
Wow. Joanna, we're just about out of time, but I want to thank you for all your important and hard work and dedication to the health, safety, and environmental hazards of leaf blowers. I wish you good luck. Keep me posted on progress. And that does it for this edition of The Green Front. Hope you've enjoyed the show. If you caught us midway, you want to go back and listen to the archives, either at theprogressiveradionetwork.com or on my show site. That's thegreenfront.com. And have a great green week. Till next time. There is no